Meet Reed Lance Rosenthal, rancher, number one best-selling award-winning author, and unabashedly, unapologetically, on the right side of the outstanding issues of our generation. But don't try to fence him in. Sometimes his positions will surprise you, because Reed is definitely his own man, with his own opinions. You might love him, you might hate him, but you won't be able to stop listening. Step over to the right side with Reed.
Happy Saturday, folks. It's Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. Boy, another week has come and gone. Not quite so tumultuous as some of the weeks prior, but nonetheless, go, go, go. And we got lots of stuff to go over this morning, and it's early. What is it? 3 a.m. 3 a.m. Saturday morning. So you'll just have to excuse me when I do the big no-no of broadcasting and take a sip of coffee here and there. Anyway, I have a great story to start off this show with, which I think you'll like. It's kind of a story of reconnection. And we're going to cover a bunch of stuff tonight. I'll probably not get to it all. There I go with the tonight thing again, since it's dark out at 3 a.m. This morning, we have a bunch of stuff to cover. I don't know if I'm going to get to it all, but we're sure as hell going to try. So we're going to be talking about, and we're going to tie it into last week's show, which was on pensions and the dire straits that pensions are in. Those of you who have any kind of retirement thing going, whether it's a pension, it's a 401k, it's an employer-sponsored fund that you personally don't control, or that you do control, the story of the pensions last week, you ought to listen to it. Because the mistakes that these big pension funds have made, individuals also make. And hopefully, the red flags that I wildly wave will help you avoid some of them. So we're also going to talk very quickly, but very importantly, about what's going on at the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, in terms of internet controls and what you can do. There's some stuff down below if you're listening to the podcast on the website page, and some things that you can do on that. It's way important. It's a little gift that Barry left us as he was leaving office. Oh, Barry, you're so kind. You love us so much. And then we're going to talk about, and it's going to tie right into pensions. Boy, it's going to tie right into last week's show. I had promised to talk about this last week, and we just didn't get to it. But this will tie in perfectly. We're going to talk about states going broke, and there's a bunch of them. But the one we're going to focus on tonight is Illinois. There I go tonight again. This morning, Illinois. Then we're going to talk about the Trump agenda, and I'm going to give you my prognostications on him getting some of his major stuff done. And that's going to include the budget and Obamacare replacement and tax reform and infrastructure. I think you'll find it interesting. We'll see how correct I am. Then we're going to delve a little bit into a story I didn't get to finish, but I had started last week, which is about this whistleblower by the name of Montgomery from the CIA, who has, number one, negotiated limited immunity for himself, and number two, come forward with 47 hard drives he took from the CIA, which proves that the CIA under Obama and our friend John Brennan, who converted to Islam in 2009 and Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, be kind. We're in cahoots in illegally, gee, what else is new, surveilling millions of Americans, particularly kind of top echelon Americans, troublemaker Americans, you know, those nasty conservatives, people like Donald Trump and I'm sure myself, whatever. I have woodpeckers working on the ranch house right now. and they've been out there for the last couple of years, and I have my own ways of dissuading them, shall we say, Wyoming style. But the more I think about it, because they keep coming back, maybe they're drones. That's what they are. They're drones. It's a good thing I wear my tinfoil. They can't hear my thoughts. And we're going to talk about, also, a new report just came out. I'm going to give it to you. I have not verified it, so I'm going to tell you right up front. But it appears that Democratic Party operatives in the FBI, imagine that. Democratic Party operatives in the FBI? Wow. Must be the deep state or the shadow government. They actually tried to bribe a Russian to say that he, working for Putin, had hacked Hillary and Podesta on behalf of Trump. Pretty interesting. That story just came out, by the way, June 19th. So just a couple days ago. We'll see if there's any more on it in any mainstream media. What do you think? You want to bet? Uh-huh. Yeah. And then we're going to talk about oil. The price of oil. And, you know, I make a lot of prognostications. And, in fact, each New Year's, I do a prognosis of what I think is going to happen, kind of in terms of major events over the course of the coming year. And I am probably 99% right on my prognostications. And some of them I wish I wasn't right on, to be quite frank with you. But I was wrong on one from a year ago. And I'm the first to tell you when I was wrong, and I was wrong. However, I was wrong in only one respect. And that is, I projected oil prices to rise rather dramatically over the course of the last year. And they did not. In fact, you know, they've been fluctuating and mostly down rather than up. But I believe, unfortunately, I was wrong only in the timing. I'm going to give you some background here. Excellent report and stats and stuff from Porter Stansberry and several other sources. And I think you'll agree when I'm done that, you know, hold on to the seat of your pants, because oil prices, gasoline, I mean, all the stuff that you use day to day that is a huge segment of your financial burden, you and your families, fuel for your car, heat, cooking, if you happen to be a gas house, whatever, you know, hold on to your wallet. But you can make your own determination. And then if we finally have time, we're going to go over some of the headlines that I have posted for you on the webpage. You know, those articles are really a treasure trove, folks. I know some of you read them. I get emails. I don't know how many of you. Many of you, you know, might be listening on your smartphones and stuff. And, you know, it's kind of a pain in the butt to read stuff on the smartphone. At least it is for me. The smartphone is way smarter than the old cowboy. But they are a wealth of information. I mean, if you spend 15, 20 minutes a week breezing through those articles, which are organized by categories, you literally will know more than probably 90% of America. And you will know more of the behind-scenes stuff than 99% of America. I spend a lot of time choosing those articles for you each week. If I don't get to that, however, make sure you read the Loony Left section of articles this week. Because loony is that's a kind word. A kind word. There's one article I don't have in there. I was too late for the cutoff date for the producers. But that is this guy, I think it was in, where was it? My producer always has all the answers. Oh, Nebraska. Yeah, Nebraska. There's this Democrat in Nebraska, state legislator, I believe, who actually was caught on tape yesterday, Friday, talking about how Scalise, the poor guy who got shot, you know, in the ballpark, the majority whip, how he was sorry that he hadn't been killed, that he should have been killed. I mean, you know, I did a whole section last week on the fact that the left, all the pundits are going, oh, both sides have to tone. Nonsense. The conservatives don't have this tone at all. What conservative has said, you know, I wish so-and-so Democrat, Gabby Giffords, what conservative talked about that poor Congress lady who was shot, by the way, by a lefty? The press keeps getting that wrong. Gee, or you think it's on purpose? By a lefty. The Democratic congresswoman was shot by a lefty loon, which seems to be most of them nowadays, down in Arizona 3-4 years back. And, yeah, 2012. Thank you. So, did you hear any conservatives jump up and down and say, God, she should have been killed? I mean, really? Outrageous. Unfortunately, there wasn't time to get that article in, but I'm pretty sure if you Google it, Democratic, just say Democrat says Scalia should have been killed. I bet you if you Google that, you'll get all the stories and probably the video, which I have watched and which is friggin' outrageous. I mean, the whole thing is outrageous. So without further ado, we're going to get rolling here. So let me tell you a story. So there is this kind of type A personality who works his butt off. It's 24/7, a million things going at once, juggling 90 million balls in the air. And he does this and he does that and he does the other. But, you know, his passions lie with the land. And although much of his work is with or in concert or on the land, he doesn't get to enjoy it all that much. And one of the things he loves to do is fly fish. And he has fly fished all over the place. Many times in Alaska, deep sea, southern climates, the Bahamas, Venezuela, Costa Rica, Belize. He's fished in the east, in upper New York State, and Vermont, and Connecticut. He spent a lot of time in Montana fishing, Wyoming, Idaho. I mean, he loves to fish. But somehow, even though he's been relatively successful by most standards, he seems to get involved in more and more and more and more and more. And instead of having more time to fish, he has less time to fish. Which seems kind of in reverse of the way things ought to work. But anyway, through his place runs this idyllic creek slash river. It's not quite big enough to be a river. It's not quite small enough to be called a creek. It's kind of perfect sized. You know, it's small and it's intimate. And he loves this creek. Because, you know, water is kind of magical. Particularly since it's in the West. And water is kind of the artery, the lifeblood of the land in what can be described as only as an arid climate. And that's kind of being kind. And you know, this creek is full of fish. Oh, nothing big. There's brown trout, 10 to 15 inches, and some rainbow trout, kind of the same size. And every once in a while a big brookie who knows where they came from. And for the last 2 years, you know, the creek, because it's in the west, I know I have a lot of listeners back east. And I'm going to divest myself, distract myself, if you will, for just a second. I want to thank all you listeners out there. Last month, we almost doubled our listenership, which has quadrupled in the past year. And I want to thank you very much and pass this link on. Or you AM listeners, pass the show on. Anyway, thanks. I digress. So this guy has planned, because this creek slash river is in the west, you know, it fluctuates. I mean, late in the summer, it's low, and it's still, and its current is slow. And the fish are holed up in deep pools. And it can be great fishing, but it's not quite the same as in the spring and early summer when the water is higher. And the best time is after runoff, when the creek is quite high and it recedes. There's still really good current. There's really good volume. It's clear as a bell. And it's more like a small river than a large creek. And he has longed to fish that creek for 2 years during that magical time between, let's call it June 5th and July 1st. Kind of that window when it's perfect. Perfect. And every time he has gotten ready to go out there and spend an hour or two in the evening, which is his preference, and cast Goddard caddis, imitations of the caddis fly, which fly and bounce and zip around in the evening as dark approaches, something has come up. Literally. For 2 years. There's been a phone call, there's been this, there's been that, there's been some kind of emergency, there's been some kind of commitment. And finally, one evening he just says, to hell with it. I'm not answering the phone. I'm not calling anybody back. I'm not doing this, that, or the other, whatever I had to do. And he decides to go out there and do it. And, although he knew it to begin with, which is, of course, why he longed to do it, to follow that passion. Because, you know, I'm going to digress just a bit. If you are a fisherman, and I'm sure many of you who are listening to me are, it's great to fish a pond. It's great to fish big turquoise flats somewhere far away. It's great to be in the wild and remote, hundreds of miles from the nearest human, doing a 3-week float in Alaska. I mean, it's all magical. Magical. Fishing really is a primal link to the land, to the artery of the land. But there's nothing quite like fishing your own water. Fishing that creek that rolls by your own place and through your own place. It gives it a special edge. So he steals out there this evening that he says, the hell with it all. And he didn't feel like putting on waders. He just kind of had his hippers on. And he tied on his trademark, which is two dry flies, sometimes three. And they're called dropper flies. Any fly more than one is called a dropper. and he ginks them up, which is this silicone stuff for you guys who don't fly fish, and you gals who don't fly fish, that you kind of dab on your fingers and dab on the fly so that it floats longer. Otherwise, they get waterlogged and sink. And he moves cautiously into the stream, and it is perfect. Crystal clear, perfect current, perfect everything. And the sun, of course, is on its way down to setting. Sunlight kind of doing a peekaboo, dapples on the water through gently waving leaves of cottonwoods and aspens. And he pauses for just a moment. Fly rod set, line out, and takes a moment to look upstream. And sure enough, in just a few seconds, there's a fish rising. Just 20, maybe 25 feet above him. A little riffle that comes down to a tiny pool that comes along an undercut bank with an overhanging branch. And the light is perfect, and the wind is perfect, and the temperature's perfect. The whole thing is perfect. And he unlimbers the fly rod, carefully watching his back cast because it's a narrow corridor through the trees that line the creek. And he sets that fly out there, and it slowly drifts down into this layer of the fish that rose a few seconds before. And there's a swirl. And he raises the rod tip and sets the hook. And lo and behold, it's about a 15-inch rainbow that dances and jumps and runs. And then when brought to hand, is gently released. A magical moment. A moment of reconnection. And a moment that absolutely the man in our story promises himself will be repeated far more often and far sooner than 2 years from that evening. That man was me last night. I thought I'd share that with you. Because it was magical. And it did reconnect me. And it did remind me that life is more than writing books. It's more than doing this radio show. It's more than running the ranch and dealing with all that pretends and helping out clients. It's a lot more. So, a story perhaps you can apply to whatever your passions are that you've put off, forsaken, got distracted from. Because life is short, folks. Life is short. Time is finite. It's the only asset that can't be replaced. Okay. Our story for this morning. Now, very quickly. So, our friend Barack Obama. Our friend Barry, who cares so much about the American people and the Republic and the Constitution and America. That it just kind of fills your heart with joy. On his way out, he got his hand-picked FCC team, which he stacked, like he stacked the courts and a bunch of other crap, the labor board, etc. He got them to pass restrictions on the internet. Actually, he got them... He got them to, you'll love this, he got them to reclassify the internet as a public utility. Now, I think we all know that the government exerts great control over public utilities, right? Power companies, gas companies, etc. Well, Barry wanted to exert control over the internet, And there was two reasons. Number one, he wanted to control the content of the internet. Gee, I wonder if that was political and ideological. I might have to take a sip of coffee here. It is now, what, 3:30. Anyway, old Barry, hold on while I take a sip and excuse me for this lapse in protocol. Oh, yum. I do love coffee. I must say, I do love coffee. And, you know, I'm not going to apologize for this. I see all these TV shows and all those guys have their coffee mugs in front of them and all that. So, On the Right Side Radio can take a coffee break in the middle of the show. Anyway, our friend Barry gets a class as a public utility with his puppets in the FCC. Not only because of the ideological power that it gives him and the political power, but his eventual plan was to impose a tax on the internet. Don't you love that? How would you like paying a tax to the United States government for your use of the internet? And I'm sure the money would be used very wisely, right? Like maybe, child tax credits for illegal aliens and anchor babies and resettling potential terrorist refugees and, you know, funding the slush fund at the Department of Justice, which then funds all the liberal groups that were Barry and Eric Holder's fan base. Yes. Anyway, that was his plan. Now, Trump, as he's doing with many of Barry's plans, thankfully, is dismantling it. And there's some new folks at the FCC, thank goodness. They have a comment period going right now on deregulating the internet. In other words, turning it back to what it was before Barry. That means not a public utility. Rather, kind of a gift to the whole world to be used freely without the government controlling content or taxing. And if you go to the politics section of the articles below, you will see this article, and it will tell you about some petitions you can sign and comments you can make, because the left, who of course wants the tax revenue to what they love more than anything in the world, which is the government, the redistribution center for social justice, the left is flooding the FCC with comments. In fact, it's rumored that George Soros is paying people to manufacture comments. That's what a big deal it is. Georgie himself is involved in trying to keep your internet regulated as a government utility. So why don't you take a moment, sign that petition. It's really easy. There's a link in the whole nine yards. And make yourself heard. You know, it's a numbers game, right? It's a numbers game. By the way, the new chairman of the FCC, whose name is Pai, P-A-I, this is getting so rancorous, and this ties right in with the loony left, and the violent loony left, and the growing ever more violent loony left. They've been camping out at Chairman Pai's house and scaring the bejesus out of his kids and occupying his offices. So you get to send two messages here, which is number one, we're not going to tolerate that crap. And number two, we want our internet back. And in the meantime, you'll get to save yourself some money too, because otherwise you'll be paying a tax for using the internet. All right. Now, our next little ditty ties right into last week's show, which is pensions are in a lot of trouble. So, you know, there are a number of states which are underwater. And I don't mean just a little underwater. I mean way underwater. California is way underwater. Of course, it's so big it can kind of move. It can move its dimes from here to there and play the Ponzi and the shell game and raise taxes and do all sorts of stuff. So they got a while longer. Although, and I talked about, I think it was the last show or the show before, their $400 billion single-payer health care plan, which they've passed but have no revenues to fund, that might put them under pretty quick. Because they are like $116 billion in the red. But they got enough mass that they can kind of survive for a while. And then there's Delaware. They're teetering. And New York is teetering. You know, you see those ads on TV, the new New York, we're building airports and roads, and you get a 10-year tax credit if you move here with your business. I mean, who the hell would want to do that? You want to open up a business and have Mayor de Blasio be regulating it? I don't think so. There's a lot more New York has to do than build airports. But we're going to talk about Illinois. And we're going to talk about Illinois for two reasons. Number one, it's the home state of who? Oh, there's Barry again. And Valerie Jarrett, too. Yeah. And Bernardine Dorn and Bill Ayers. It's quite the crew that comes from Chicago. And Rahm Emanuel. Yes, Illinois. That's number one. Number two, because Illinois is a little bit more advanced than these other states that are drowning. It's drowned. It is the first state to run out of money. It won't be the last, but it is the very first. And I'm not making this up. I'm not being overly dramatic. They are flat out of money. Let me give you some stats which will just shock you. First of all, though, I'm going to tell you that they're out of money. Why? I know you can figure this out because I've given you a bunch of hints so far this morning. Because of their pensions. The state pensions. And the corrupt unions that run state employees who got all these pensions, and the corrupt politicians who get their donations from the unions, who promised and passed laws mandating these pensions when there was no money to pay for them years ago. Well, guess what? As Reverend Wright preached to Barry and Michelle, the chickens have come home to roost. Oh, yes, they have. This is going to shock you. This is Illinois. By the way, did you notice that those four states that are in the most dire straits? Four states in the most dire straits. I'm a poet and I don't know it. Those four states are all what? Oh, that's right. Blue states. States that have been run by Democrats. Progressives. Corrupt liberals for years. You think that's a coincidence? It's not. Now, Illinois, folks, let me tell you what's happening in Illinois, which, of course, the mainstream media is not a whisper. We're not going to talk about this. It's really not happening. If we don't mention it, nobody will know. In fact, when Illinois goes bankrupt, nobody will even find out because we won't have it on our news channel. Oh, boy. Okay. Illinois has not passed a budget for almost 3 years, 700 days to be exact. Does that sound like anything? Oh, that's right. Barry didn't pass a budget for 8 years for the United States, and our debt went up $10 trillion. Oh, there are similarities here. Woohoo. The Illinois Department of Transportation just told their contractors, I'm going to read you part of the letter. It's unbelievable. just told their contractors that they will not be able to pay them, that they are to cease all work on any public works projects, conducting such work only as is necessary to make them safe as they leave the job, and that they'll be in touch on maybe paying them sometime in the future. Not making this up. Wait till I read you some of this stuff. Illinois' own governor, Bruce Rauner, that's Rauner, has termed his own state, the state he is governor of, a banana republic. Wow. The state's comptroller just came out and said, "We are in a massive crisis mode." These are quotes, folks, quotes. There's a reporter for the Chicago Tribune who just wrote a story. And what he says is, I quote, "Dissolve Illinois, decommission the state, tear up the charter, whatever the legal mumbo-jumbo, just end the whole dang thing. We just disappear with no pain." That's right, you heard me. "The best thing to do is break Illinois into pieces right now. Wipe us off the map. Get us out of America's heartland and let the neighboring states carve us up and take the best chunks for themselves. The group that will scream the loudest is the state's political class who did this to us, and the big bond creditors who are whispering talk of bankruptcy and asset forfeiture to save their own skins. But our beloved Illinois has proved that it just doesn't deserve to survive." Wow. I mean, that. Woo! Anyway, the root of Illinois' problem, and they got many problems. I mean, it's systemic. But the root of the problems is their unfunded pension liabilities, which come to $130 billion. $130 billion. You know, all the corrupt leaders, the union, the politics, all in bed together, they promised what they couldn't deliver, and they knew they couldn't deliver it when they promised it, folks. Their laws are blue state laws. Many of these state employees can retire in their 50s. That means they're going to live 30, 35 years getting funded these. Well, I guess they're not going to get funded these pensions now, but getting funded these pensions. The state actually stole hundreds of millions of dollars, and I'm using the word stole, hundreds of millions of dollars from its federal Medicaid funding to make pension payments and pay operating costs over the last year. And now they've been socked by a court order which says you will repay Medicaid first out of the state treasury every month, and you will pay your pensions second out of the state funds every month. And what that does, folks, that means they are broke. They are have now been ordered by the court to make these payments to repay the stolen money from Medicaid. You know, basically they stole from their own citizens. And to pay the pensions they promised to pay, which they can't. Which leaves them with zero. That's right, zero. Goose egg. Nothing. Nada. To pay out for anything else. And when I say anything else, I mean anything else like even these infrastructure projects. You know, roads, bridges, the basic maintenance. Basic maintenance. So they've been downgraded by Moody's, obviously. To give you some comparative numbers, remember, this is a blue state run by corrupt Democrats for years and years and years. Barry Obama's state, Valerie Jarrett's state, etc., etc., etc. Public pensions around the United States, state public pensions are underfunded by $375 billion, folks. The majority of that 300, not, shall we say more than half, actually far more than half, is New York, Illinois, California, and Delaware. The rest is spread out amongst a number of states. By the way, this is a global phenomenon. This is not just happening in the United States. There is a $78 trillion, this is worldwide, this ties right into my show last year, $78 trillion in unfunded liabilities in both private and public pensions around the globe. I didn't make that number up. That's $78 trillion with a T, dollars. $78 trillion. That's the entire GDP of the United States of America for approximately 5 years. And that would just get them even. I'm talking about the underfunding. Wow. But $130 billion of that is our subject of this morning's talk, Illinois. By the way, if Illinois does go bankrupt, and it's likely that it will, I mean, I think you'll start hearing about this here over the next 30 or 60 days. Number one, you know what's going to happen. All of us, like me in Wyoming, a red state with billions in its reserve coffers, even after a two-year energy recession, we're going to wind up bailing out those blue states. And you know what? That doesn't make me happy at all. Not at all. Stand on your own 2 feet or fall. I mean, this redistribution of wealth thing, it just doesn't do it for me. You know, it just really doesn't do it for me. I'd rather give willingly to a charity than have it taken by the government to be paid to who knows who for who knows what. Probably something not in my best interest. Or in the best interest of the Constitution or American values, I might add. So, as some other stats here on our subject... Oh, I wanted to read you part of this letter. Oh, we'll get to that. We'll get to that. I mean, this is like a story that could go... I could do the whole show just on this. The whole show. So, there's an investment guy, very well known, by the name of Mish Shedlock. His actual name is Mike, by the way. He reports that in addition to this $130 billion hole in pensions, the state is now in arrears in its operating costs. We were talking about, like, you know, the utilities for the state capital, like the lights and the heat and the other stuff, paper supplies, by $14.3 billion. That's right. They owe their creditors $14.3 billion just for operating costs that they haven't paid. Five of Illinois' universities were just downrated into junk bond status by Moody's. Now, Illinois' universities probably deserve to be called junk, as do many of the so-called bastions of higher learning around the country. You've been seeing what's going on there. But I'm using this as an indication, shall we say, as another little point to show you just how broke this state is due to decades of corrupt, progressive non-policy. Of buying votes with other people's money. That's really what it comes down to. Pam Simon is the director of Illinois' Office of Business and Workforce Diversity. You know, only in a blue state, workforce diversity. Okay. Quote, this is her letter. At this time, appropriate funding is not available after June 30th. She's writing to her contractors. After June 30th, 2017. Gee, I think that's, well, my. 6 days from now. On July 1, all work shall cease except for maintenance of existing traffic controls, maintenance of erosion and sediment controls, and such efforts that will secure conditions of danger to highway system users as directed by the engineer, the state engineer she's talking about. Let me keep going on this. This is an amazing letter. Now, let's assume you're a small business that's been supplying the state paper clips, and you haven't been paid for 6 months. You think that has an effect on you? Do you think that has an effect on how many employees you have? Do you think that when you fire those employees, or you lay them off, or you cut their hours, and they pay less taxes, that doesn't have an effect on the state coffers, which are already empty? Do you see how this is like a conundrum? This is like a rat on a wheel chaser. The faster you go, the further into the hole you get. Let's assume you're a contractor. You know, and you got 50, 60, 70 guys and gals working for you, and, you know, you're all happy because you got this state contract to redo 17 miles of Interstate 80, or, you know, rebuild the bridge over the River Kwai, whatever. And all these people are depending upon you, and they're all taxpayers. And you get this letter, and the letter says, the contract document governing the performance, that means the contract you have with the state to build the bridge or fix the highway, provides the obligations of the state shall cease immediately without penalty or further payment being required if, in any fiscal year, the Illinois General Assembly or federal funding source fails to appropriate or otherwise make available funds for all contracts. At this time, appropriate funding is not available after June 30th, 2017. Thus, work shall cease effective June 30th, 2017. On July 1, 2017, I'm skipping a little bit, all work shall cease except for maintenance of existing traffic, blah, 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 blah. It is the department's intent to initiate work on the project immediately after a budget resolution and appropriations are made. In other words, you have no say in this deal. You have a contract with the state of Illinois. You have a business that is depending upon, and you have planned for, the income from the hard work you're doing out there for the people of the state of Illinois. You have your 50, 60, 70, however many guys and gals that are working for you, depending upon their paychecks for their families. And you have, ironically, the same state that's shoving it up your butt, depending upon you and all of them to pay their taxes because it's broke. And you're just going to have to lay everybody off. And you have nothing to say about it. You have no legal redress. You have no way to get your money. You're just screwed. Welcome to progressive government. Now, to try and get its way out of the hole, and this goes back to that round robin catch 22, the rat on the treadmill deal. Do you know what Illinois did over the last year? Because they saw this coming, they knew they were going to lose this court case, and it was going to be like the sword of Damocles falling. They raised taxes. Isn't that what progressives do? tax and spend, tax and spend, tax and spend, buy votes with other people's money to keep your power and enrich yourselves at the public's expense whom you're supposed to be serving and in violation of your oath of office. New taxes by Illinois over the last year total $31.6 billion. Think about all the money, folks, that that took out of the pockets of those who work in Illinois. And I'm going to get into some stats here for you in just a second, which will blow your mind. So those poorer folks who want to stand on their own 2 feet and not be on the public dole, which a huge amount of the population, including illegal aliens in Sanctuary City, Chicago, are on. Those poor people had $31.6 billion taken out of their government, taken out of their pocket by this progressive, failed government that the big cities of Illinois have elected for, you know, 40 plus years to the detriment of everybody else in the state. And that means they didn't have the money to spend on a movie, or they didn't have the money to spend on a new dress or a new pair of jeans or a new car, whatever it was. It's money out of the economy that the state has absorbed. And it's less money for all the other businesses that depend on these taxpayers. And ironically, in the end, it's less money for the failed state. Now, you're going to love this. Of the $31.6 billion in new taxes Illinois stole from its working citizens, they were able to... Boy, this is unbelievable. They were able to reduce their backlog of bills by, guess how much? They got in $31.6 billion. How much went to pay their backlog of bills? $1.3 billion. That's right. 1/30, give or take, of their new tax revenue went to pay their bills. The rest went to what the court ordered them to do, repay Medicaid that they stole, the money they stole from Medicaid, and to fund the pensions that they knew they could never fund when they passed them, and on whom yet more people and families and businesses are relying. That's pretty amazing. During this period of time, happens to be 2010 through 2015, despite this increase in taxes, despite the allocation of 29/30, that is 5%, 96% of those monies to their unfunded liabilities, the pensions and Medicaid, their pension liability increased $25 billion. So they took in $31 billion in new tax revenue, reduced their operating bills by $1.3 billion, so they're only $14 billion behind in turning on the lights. And the debt, the obligation they directed the tax monies at, $29 billion of $30 billion, went up $25 billion. In the last month, Illinois has been called a failed state by Politico, the Heritage Foundation, and even the Chicago Tribune. Yet, you haven't heard a word about it in the mainstream media, have you? Uh-uh. That's the fake news of omission and distortion. And, of course, all the government liberals are now in a panic. What are they going to do? How much can they raise taxes again? What money can they get from the federal government? What money can they get from poor old Reed in Wyoming, or Sally Lou in Colorado, or Betty May in Indiana? This is like Greece, folks. In fact, it might be worse than Greece. And I've done a bunch of shows on Greece. Look up, type in the search bar, for those of you who are new listeners, type in the search bar, Greece is California. I did that show 3 years ago. This is like, talking about Illinois today is like talking about Greece 3 years ago. Which, by the way, has never been solved either. They just go further and further and further in the hole, and the European Union keeps funding their deficits, hoping, I don't know what they're hoping, that it all goes away. I have no idea. The comptroller of Illinois is Susana Mendoza. She has to prioritize what gets paid. I feel badly for her. I really do. I mean, I'm sure she didn't create this mess, right? There are more people unemployed in Illinois right now than at any time since the Great Depression. There are more people getting public assistance in Illinois right now than at any time since the Great Depression. Yet the progressives in Illinois, in a desperate bid to keep their power, want to take all the state's resources, I mean literally all, which is nothing after this court-ordered payment stuff, and they want to direct it at social programs to support the people in Illinois who don't work, using the money of the people in Illinois who do. And this story, folks, is being played out to varying degrees in numerous other states, virtually all of them blue states, and three or four of them on the heels of Illinois in terms of their plight. And let me tell you, Illinois' problems, as monumental as they are insignificant in terms of total dollars to California and New York. And if any of these big blue states fail, it will have a terrible ripple effect on the American economy and perhaps the global economy. I can't emphasize that enough. And this wasn't created by Trump, and I don't know how he fixes it. It is a friggin' mess. No doubt about it. Anyway, Mendoza says that there is no money, zero, nada, nothing, left for discretionary spending. That in Illinois, folks, and you parents out there in Illinois, who I know I have listeners in Illinois, I get emails from you. That includes school buses, domestic violence shelters, and ambulance services. Wow. Terrific. I just think that we need more progressive government. Don't you think? Yeah, you bet. By the way, to show you how corrupt Illinois is, in the midst of this literally being broke, I mean, not just out of money, but like, billions of dollars underwater, like overdrawn checking account. The Illinois state legislature, blue as they can be, just voted to appropriate $100 million. That's $100 million. That's one-tenth of a billion to fund or help fund. What do you think? What do you think they voted in the midst of this incredible crisis? In the midst of higher taxes for the workers of Illinois? In the midst of stealing money from Medicaid just to turn the lights on? And in the midst of a of literally being on the verge of wrecking the retirement of thousands and thousands of Illinois state employees and their families. The Illinois legislature appropriated $100 million to assist with the building of the Obama Library. You can't make this stuff up. You really can't make this stuff up. All right. Let's move on to our next segment, shall we? And as usual, I'm verbose and windy, and hopefully we're going to cover everything. The Trump agenda. I'm going to do this quickly. Just going to give you my prognosis. I'm going to run down his agenda, and I'm going to tell you what I think his chances are of getting it done. This is based on three assumptions. Number one, that nothing really comes out of the investigations of Trump, despite the best efforts of the deep state, which I think will be the outcome. Number two, that the pendulum of these investigations, I'm going to talk about this here in the next segment, begins to swing, and I think you can feel it, can't you? Can you feel the pendulum swinging? I mean, I think you really can. I think it's one of the reasons the left is getting more dogmatic, more violent, more strident, more outrageous, because I think they can feel it too. And the pendulum is swinging away from Trump and toward Hillary and Rice and Lynch and Brennan. And I kind of projected that it would. Well, I'm going to talk about that in the next segment. But that's the second assumption. And the third assumption is there's no gigantic international or economic wreck. In other words, there is no major conflict that arises on the international scene, a shooting conflict, or a close-to-shooting conflict, if with another superpower. And number two, that there is no cataclysmic domestic financial event such as Illinois going bankrupt. Those are my three assumptions. Based on those three assumptions, here's what I think is going to happen. And the biggest enemy of Trump, folks, is not the Democrats. We know what they are. They don't know what they are, but we know what they are. It is the Rhino Republicans, and in some cases, the obstinate non-Rhino Republicans, who can't seem to, you know, I could be vulgar and crude, but I'm not that type of gentleman, who just can't seem to kind of get out of their own way. How's that? Number one, the budget. So we got a big budget fight coming up, and it has to be done by October 1, or you have a big budget mess. I would say that we have a 95% chance that something will get done, even though it might be kicking the can down the road, which this government's been doing for, you know, 20 years now. It's one of the reasons we're $20 trillion in debt, in primary debt, and in the case of America, $100 trillion or more in unfunded liabilities. And by the way, I've done whole shows on that with some great national interviews like with Shah Jalani. Type up in the search bar if you want to listen to those shows, Unfunded Liabilities, and listen to them. I actually did them years ago. And here we are. Here we are, unfortunately. Obamacare repeal and replace. You know, I got several emails from listeners in the last week wanting to know what I thought of and what I talk about this Obamacare replacement deal. And I've talked a little bit about the House version. I will admit I am not familiar at all with the Senate version, other than to know enough to tell you it's really kind of watered down Obamacare. I mean, it's really not. There's some important new stuff in it. There's some important fixes in it, but I can't call it Obamacare repeal, which I think needs to be done. And I really am not conversant on it. I'm not sure anybody is. So I can't give you an opinion on it yet. But what I'm talking about this morning is its chances of passing even in its current, quote-unquote, unknown form. And I wouldn't put it better than 40%. I think this is going to be a big disappointment and a big political problem for the Republicans going into 2018 if they don't get this done. And do I think it should be passed? Once again, I don't know enough about it. I think whatever you pass is going to be better than the wreck you have, Obamacare. And hopefully, using the structure of Obamacare, which affords very wide latitude to the Secretary of Health and Human Services, HHS, who is now Tom Price, who is tough, smart, a former doctor, and gets it. If he has a lot of latitude, there's a lot of stuff he can do to health care if he has the new framework to build on. And hopefully that occurs. Because I don't think we're going to do any better than that. Not with, you know, Republican senators all over the board and Republican House members all over the... I mean, just, it's a disunited party, and you're not going to get... If you get one vote in the Senate, it might be Manchin from West Virginia. But I don't know. I doubt it. Tax reform. I would put that as somewhere between 45 to 55% that some type of tax reform beneficial to the economy will get done. I don't know if it's going to get done this year, but it's going to get done in Trump's first 2 years. Infrastructure. I don't put infrastructure at more than 10% getting done this year, although it should be a slam dunk. If the Democrats, you know, had one living brain cell. Now, next year, 40 to 50%. But once again, you know, everybody's going to try and load it with pork and put a bunch of crap in it, and who knows what's going to happen. Dodd-Frank reform. For those of you who are not familiar with Dodd-Frank, it is this horrific financial institution regulatory law passed by, of all people, the two people, along with Maxine Waters, most responsible for the housing blow-up in 2008 and the collapse of Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, and that is Crooked Chris Dodd from Connecticut, thank God, no longer senator, and disgusting Barney Frank. Wasn't he from Illinois? I'm not sure. But Barney was a piece of work. Piece of work. And I have done whole shows on this, too. Type in savings and loan in the search bar. Type in Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae in the search bar. Listen to those shows. I explain how that whole mess originated, why it was the fault lays squarely in what's called the Community Reinvestment Act and Barney Frank and Chris Dodd's implementation of that, you know, and the Democrats behind it trying to buy votes once again with other people's money. And that created the subprime mortgage crisis and the bonds that backed the mortgages and on and on and on and on. So, when Dodd-Frank was passed, the bigger banks grumbled, but they kind of supported it, and they supported it for one reason, because they knew it would impose an onerous burden, reporting, paperwork, compliance, you name it, on smaller banks, community banks, regional banks, and it would knock a lot of them out of business. So what would happen then? Oh, that's right, the big banks would move into the vacuum and expand their business. You know, kind of like the coyote who waits to eat the remains. So the government, with its regulations, knock off the little guys, and the big guys come in and feed on the carcasses. That's Dodd-Frank. any of you have bought a house lately or done a loan lately and sat there at the desk and looked at the 5 inches of paperwork that you got to sign and asked yourselves, where the hell did this come from? It came from Dodd-Frank, folks. It came from Dodd-Frank. I don't think Dodd-Frank's going to be repealed because I don't think people have the political cojones to do it, although it needs to be. But hopefully it will get revised to take the pressure off small town, community, and regional banks who are staggering under the weight of its regulatory burden, staggering under the weight of it. And the direct effect is less loans for you. Car loans, house loans, business loans, particularly business loans. Main Street can't get a loan. I mean, I don't know about you. I don't care how bad I needed a loan. I would never go to Wells Fargo. I would never go to Bank of America. I would never go to Citicorp. If you deal with the top 10 big banks in this country, you are crazy. Crazy. Google up derivatives. When we had the blow up in 2008, these banks had like 78 or 79 billion in derivatives. That's like financial instruments that they then split off into pieces and sell out and do some type of guarantee and buy back on and all that kind of stuff. And derivatives are what caused kind of the global meltdown that rolled out like waves from the collapse of Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, which was precipitated by the subprime mortgage crisis, which was precipitated by our friends Barney Frank and Chris Dodd. I mean, honest to God, you couldn't make this up. You couldn't make this up. So hopefully Dodd-Frank will be watered down. I think that's the best we can see. And let me tell you, I put it at less than 30% that it gets done. 30%. Sanctions on Iran, sanctions on Russia, very tough potential military action against North Korea, and maybe after the 2018 elections against Iran, I put it at 60-70%. The wall. The wall. I think Congress is going to chicken out. I'd give you 80-20 against the wall, and I'm a big proponent of the wall. And I give you 80% chance that instead they're going to run behind the cover of more money for border security. But once again, folks, and I've talked about this in previous shows, type in immigration in the search bar, the reason people don't want a wall built is because it's permanent. And all the progressives are hoping that Donald Trump, well, if you watch TV, either gets assassinated or whatever. I mean, these people are nuts. And certainly that he is president only for one term, or actually that he gets impeached before the term is over. In which case, the progressives can come back in, and if there's no wall, there's nothing permanent to reverse. How easy is this? And how simple to deduce? So, unfortunately, I don't think the wall is going to happen in the next 2 years. I wish it could happen tomorrow. Personally speaking, immigration reform. I give it 20% sometime in the next 2 years, and I'm being kind. Really kind. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, oh, here they are again. Oh, my. Reforming those mortgage behemoths that you can just call them behemoths, which were basically taken over by the government. They were quasi-private prior to the meltdown 2008-2009. I'd give that about 50%, and that would be great for the mortgage market and great for the deconstruction of the government. So, the military buildup, I give that 90%. That's my prognosis. Now, moving on to the next segment quickly. So, I started talking about this before. In fact, last week we ran out of time. So, you have this guy Montgomery, CIA operative, appalled at the illegal surveillance of up to 20 million Americans. Bank accounts, credit cards, spending habits, travel habits, phone calls, emails, you name it. Credit reports, banking information that under Barry Obama and John Brennan was being put together. Completely in contravention of the law. Not that Barry Obama cares about the law. And look, the whole thing is treason, right? It's treason. John Brennan, Barack Obama, Valerie Jarrett, Susan Rice, Hillary Clinton, Ben Rhodes, you can go right down the list. They committed treason. This is not just some ignoring the law or fragrant violation of a obscure federal statute. This is treason. This undermines the basic financial security of the United States and usurps all sorts of constitutional rights, including under the Fourth Amendment, of individual Americans. It's illegal as hell. Yet they did it anyway. So Montgomery came forward. He managed to snitch 47 hard drives from the CIA. And he went through the proper channels. And he got immunity. And now there's this big investigation of what's going on. And that's going to tie right into where I hope Robert Mueller, the special counsel, is going to be going. Because that pendulum, I talked about it just a few minutes ago, is swinging. You can feel it. You know, there's some diehards still talking about Trump-Russia collusion, but everybody, particularly after Comey's testimony, has pretty much given up that ghost. You know, the obstruction of justice thing is like hot air. Comey's testimony lets Trump off the hook. I mean, basically he said it didn't happen. And now the Republicans in Congress, because of the special elections, which, by the way, I know many of you followed my suggestion and went and gave your 10 or 20 or 40 or 50, whatever it is, to the guy in South Carolina and Handel in Georgia. And, of course, we won both of those elections. Right now in special elections, it is Patriots 5 and Progressives 0. That's a good thing. But there are warning signs in terms of margins. I'm not going to talk about that this morning. So Montgomery, and by the way, the reporter on this is Sarah Carter, who's done a hell of a job. He also sued the FBI and James Comey. Because he originally delivered it to Comey, who promised to investigate and then shelved it. Gee, kind of sounds like Loretta Lynch's investigation of Hillary, doesn't it? It's a pattern, folks. There ain't no coincidences. Not in the swamp. According to Montgomery, all the evidence he gave to the FBI was about warrantless surveillance. In other words, nobody went to a FISA court and all this smokescreen that's being thrown up. They just went out and did it. And he has sued the FBI and Comey for that. And fortunately for us, Montgomery was awarded, the judge that was appointed to his case happens to be the same federal judge who recently ruled that the NSA's collection of data on Americans violates the U.S. Constitution's Fourth Amendment. So, it should be pretty damn interesting. Anyway, Montgomery, he says that 20 million Americans, more than 20 million American identities, were illegally unmasked. I mean, we're not talking about General Flynn now. We're talking about 20 million of us. Credit reports, emails, phone conversations, internet traffic were all collected by the NSA and the CIA. Hey, John Brennan. Yeah, John Brennan. Quote, they're doing this domestic surveillance on Americans running a project on U.S. soil. Can you imagine what someone can do with the information they were collecting on Americans? Can you imagine that kind of power? Another quote. By the way, he's represented by Larry Klayman, an excellent attorney and a well-known conservative activist attorney. Part of that lawsuit, and I think this sums it up the best, once again, you're not seeing this on the mainstream media, are you? No. Mm-mm. Quote, plaintiffs were assured that the FBI, under defendant Comey, would conduct a full investigation into the grave instances of illegal and unconstitutional activity set forth by Montgomery. However, the FBI, on defendant Comey's orders, buried the FBI's investigation because the FBI itself is involved in an ongoing conspiracy to not only conduct the aforementioned illegal, unconstitutional surveillance, but to cover it up as well. Unquote. By the way, the federal judge, thank you for the reminder, producer. The federal judge is U.S. District Court, the Washington, U.S. District Court Judge Richard Leon, L-E-O-N. All right. I'll keep you up to the breast on that story because I kind of find it fascinating. And I think it ties right into the deep state stuff now. And I think Comey is in it up to his eyeballs. And I think we're going to learn a lot more about this because Susan Rhodes got subpoenaed, including all her documents relative to unmasking. You're going to love this. And now she is fighting that subpoena. You can't make this stuff up. Because the Barack Obama library, remember the library that Illinois is going to contribute $100 million from their coffers, which don't have money to even take care of their own citizens? That library has now said that it has the records. She turned them over to it, defying a subpoena. And under law, if you turn it over to a presidential library, they can keep it sealed for 5 years. You think Barry might have had anything to do with this unmasking thing? Gee, wonder. Wonder about that. I don't think you have to wonder about it at all. I think that question has been asked and answered by this very clever, but really sordid, really nasty, really treasonous attempt to keep these documents from Congress. And to save their own necks in the process, of course, which is really all they'll ever care about. And Hillary Clinton is now under investigation again. I was one of the first to report that. That was 2 months ago. She's under investigation by the FBI for certain nasty stuff. And now she's under investigation by a Senate committee. By the way, if you go to the politics section, I'm sorry, the Hillary section of the articles down below, if you're listening to the podcast, you'll see a thing about WikiLeaks and Hillary. And there's a video. And Julian Assange comes out with some new stuff. I mean, I think the video just came out in the last few days. You should listen to that video. And the Republicans are finally getting some spine, and they are about to launch into a new investigation of Hillary. One can only hope these congressional investigations of Rhodes and Brennan and Hillary and all that kind of stuff are noticed by an impartial special counsel, i.e. Bob Mueller. But I think the pendulum is beginning to swing. And we will see if my prognostication that zero happens to Trump and the Democrats rue the day as all their top folks get in deep hot water. Rue the day they ask for a special counsel. We shall see. The other thing which came to light this week, June 19th, in fact, is there's now a report that Democratic Party operatives in the FBI. It's amazing how all this stuff seems to be coming up with this one agency now. The CIA under Brennan and the FBI under Comey. Cozy, cozy, cozy. So they say that this guy, Nikulin, N-I-K-U-L-I-N, if you want to Google him up. Nikulin and his attorneys, he's in Czechoslovakia, and the United States is trying to extradite him, and Russia's trying to extradite him, and all sorts of crap's going on. But he maintains that in November, right after the election, and February 7th, right after the inauguration, FBI agents came to his jail in Czechoslovakia, offered him immunity and money to quote-unquote admit that he hacked Podesta, the DNC, Hillary's, whatever, emails, that Putin directed him to do it, and that he gave the information to and consorted with Trump to accomplish his mischievous end. There is film in the Czechoslovakian prison. I believe it's Czechoslovakia. It's one of the Slavic countries. There is film in the prison of FBI agents on the February 7th visit. There doesn't seem to be a confirmation yet of the November visit, but he was visited by the FBI on foreign soil February 7th. Yes, the Czech Republic. That's exactly where he's being held. Exactly. What a memory. My God. I don't care how early it is on a Saturday morning. There's nothing I forget. Boy, I wish that was true. Anyway, they were going to grant him U.S. citizenship, drop all the charges, give him cash, and give him an apartment if he would agree to all this. Who was the director of the FBI then? Oh, yeah, James Comey. Huh. What a coincidence. It's another one of those coincidences, folks. Wow. Unbelievable. Anyway, Nikulin refused the deal. And the bottom line is that this is a story that we need to follow because it really does tie in kind of beautifully with the whole conjure and frame up that the Dems have tried to do with this Russian collusion thing. I mean, remember that James Comey wanted to pay the Democratic scumbag operative who manufactured from whole cloth, I mean, like out of the thin air, should write novels. The whole story about the ladies of the night, five ladies of the night being hired by Trump to urinate on the bed that Obama and Michelle slept in a Russian hotel. Do you remember all that? The dossier, it was called, the dossier. The golden shower dossier. which turned out to be completely manufactured, completely fabricated by these guys. And Comey wanted to hire these guys and pay them. You know, it's and that's been verified. That's a verified fact. So this Nikulin thing, trying to buy a witness against Trump, doesn't surprise me in the least. Doesn't surprise me in the least. Now, I am going to have time, briefly, unfortunately, to cover this oil deal. Because I think it's really important. Really important. I may go over a little bit, in which case, you AM stations, which, by the way, most AM stations have switched me to an hour and a half. Thank you. You know, can't get enough hot air on the way on the airwaves. Hot air on the airwaves. Hot airwaves. But I'm going to go over. So there. Better give me 2 hours. Oh, my. Oil. I predicted a year ago, it might have been a year and a half ago, oil was going to go up dramatically. I base this on possible increased economic demand, Mideast conflict, and a number of other factors. In point of fact, what's happened is, because of Trump's deregulation, his deconstruction of the regulatory state, and let me give you some stats on that just to get you, and oil and gas and energy are a big part of it. The regulations that have been passed since Trump took office, never mind what he's taken off the books, which is huge. Huge, as he would say. Huge. Are only 8% of the regulations passed by Obama in any comparative time period of Obama's presidency to Trump's first, quote-unquote, 6 months. And the cost, the compliance cost of those regulations, in Obama's time, he would have passed 92% more regulations that would have cost, on average, hold on to your seats, $46 billion to comply with. Remember we were talking about Dodd-Frank and how that cost of compliance is driving small banks, community banks, and some regional banks out of business, much to the delight of Citicorp and Credit Suisse and, you know, all the big carnivores out there. But, the cost of those regulations that Barry would have passed in any typical six-month period, comparative six-month period, was $46 billion. The cost of Trump's regulations in his first 6 months, new regulations in his first 6 months, is $33 million. That's $33 million versus $46 billion. That is $45.7 billion more in the pockets of Americans to spend and grow the economy. Right? Make America great again. All right. Because of the deregulations in the energy industry and economics, I mean, there's a host of factors. In some cases, necessity just to stay afloat. Drill rigs in the last 2 weeks, give or take, are up 8. I know that doesn't sound like a lot. This is in the United States. That's a lot, folks. That's a lot. They're up 525 rigs from this time last year. That's unbelievable. At the low point of this oil downturn, there was less than, and I may be a few off, but it'll give you, I'm in the ballpark. There were less than 216 rigs operating. Now there are over 800. 1 year later, there's over 800 operating. I can tell you that I hear ads, and I haven't heard them for years. The last time I heard them was probably 2013 or 14. I've heard ads on the Casper and the Cheyenne radio stations advertising for oil field workers. drillers, mechanics, drivers, Halliburton folks, you name it. I haven't heard that in years. They're advertising for folks, and they're paying, you know, these are $75,000, $80,000, $100,000, $125,000 a year jobs. I mean, they're damn good paying jobs. But that's what deregulation does. Because of that, the American oil industry, energy industry, has burgeoned much more quickly than most people anticipated, including yours truly, I might add. Flat wrong on it. And that huge amount of oil, and producers have figured out how to make oil, how to make money at $50 a barrel. Before this, it had to be $80 a barrel. But, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. So all this new oil from America going onto the market, the fact that the OPEC nations, for their own greedy little personal designs, can't keep a pact to keep production limited, the fact that Russia is desperate to sell as much oil as it can because, really, that's its largest form of currency inflow. And Iran, back in the oil market thanks to Berry, also desperate to sell oil and make money, have all conspired to keep oil prices low. However, and this is a really big however, if you look down the road just a little bit, I'm going to give you some amazing stats. So America right now is the largest oil consumer on the planet. Okay, we're number one. Japan is a close second, and they use a lot of oil. The total population of Japan and America is 450 million people. 100 million over there, 350 million give or take here. That's 6% of the world's population. So the United States, to put this in perspective, with a population of one-fifth of China, the next largest economy in the world, consumes twice as much oil as China. But China, folks, for all its economic woes, and it has them, despite its growth, is in the middle of another kind of industrial revolution. You know, it's where all our jobs went. So we're in the 1800s, we were creating all these jobs because we were the industrial might of the world and the early 20th century or the mid-20th century. Now it's China. You know, standard of living's on the rise. More and more Chinese are driving cars, scooters, watching TV, using electricity, and making a lot of stuff. China's economy has grown 900%. That's 900% since 1999. It's now the world's second largest economy. And by the way, depending upon which measure you use, it is the world's largest. It passed us. But on the most strictly used international standard, it's still behind us. But it has a GDP of about 10 trillion, or it's about 16 on that measurement basis. And Asian oil consumption has risen dramatically, too. I mean, basically from 24 million barrels of oil a day in 2005 to 31 million barrels a day. 31 million barrels a day today. That's just 12 years. That's a huge, huge increase. And you know who can move the needle even more than China? Who is moving the needle? India. There's 1.3 billion people in India. That is three times the combined population of the United States and Japan. Right now, India uses 1.5 billion barrels of oil per year. That's about 4.1 million barrels per day, by the way. That's a fraction. Now, understand this. That's a fraction of the oil that China now uses. and an even smaller fraction of the amount of oil that Japan or America uses. But India is also in the midst of a huge boom in its quote-unquote new middle class, kind of like China. They project 241 million. Think about that. I mean, that's almost the population of the United States. 241 million people will be added to the workforce in India by the year 2030. I mean, that's staggering, staggering number. And obviously, these people have money. They're going to spend it. You know what they're going to spend it on? Oh, yeah, cars and scooters. You bet. Why? Take a look at China. China's just a few years ahead of India. So India, even more than China, is expected to be the fastest growing consumer of oil in the world. Through 2040. I mean, this is a long time. And it's projected that they will be up to 10.4 billion barrels of oil a day. In the next 10 years. That's 2.5 times the oil they're using today. The same with China. Listen, folks, there's a finite supply of oil and a finite supply of producers. Even if you have new businesses and, you know, the business can buy a rig and operate it. I mean, I'm not going to make the mistake of underestimating the American oil industry again. I mean, it's pretty unbelievably impressive what's happened over the last 8 years. But there's a limit to how much you can produce. And there's a limit to how much you can ship out. So all those factors which have combined to keep oil prices down, making me wrong, over the past year, year and a half, are beginning to reverse. And they're not just reversing in a cyclical manner. They're reversing in a structural manner. A long-term manner. The bottom line is enjoy low oil prices now. Because you're going to see them go up and up and up and up. I can't tell you, and I'm not going to. I got burned last time doing this. I can't tell you how fast it's going to happen. I can't tell you how high they're going to go. But they're going to be, and I'm going to say 5 years from now, they're going to be a lot higher than they are now. So that is my prognosis. That is my revised prognosis. How's that? Now, the very last thing I want to do before I sign off this morning, because I'm 12 minutes over my time. Bad me. Shame on me. Bad cowboy. Bad cowboy. The last thing I want to do is I want to apologize to my readers, because I don't know what happened at Amazon. It's unbelievable. I'm late on getting book 4 out anyway for a host of reasons. I won't bore you with them. It's coming very soon, so is 5. Stay tuned to our website, ThreadsWestSeries.com, www.threadswestseries.com, or go to Facebook, follow the Threads West page, www.facebook.com/ThreadsWest. Or you can even follow me on my page. You'll have to be a follower, because unfortunately I've hit that ridiculous 5,000 friend limit. And thank you, by the way, to all those people who are my friends. Amazon, I didn't even know it until I got an email this morning, actually a number of emails this morning, from disgruntled, understandably so, readers saying, what the hell is going on? We just got a notice from Amazon that book 4 isn't coming out till December 30th. I went, what? Say what? And I called my publishers, and they didn't know anything about it. So I don't know how it happened or what. Who's playing the practical joke. or Amazon got its logarithm. I don't know what happened, but you'll see that date change back to the release date, which is pretty damn soon. And I apologize for giving everybody heart attacks, you know, Alka-Seltzer moments, heart gel moments, 911 moments, because the wrong release date was, we had no knowledge of it. We didn't do it. We're innocent. You call me Hillary. It was the DNC's fault. It was Russia's fault. Russia hacked my Amazon page. Where? Yeah, whatever. So we're going to get that corrected. And I can't wait to get the books in your hands. And thanks for reading them. And all of you, thanks for listening. Pass on the link. We'll get the right side just about right everywhere. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal. You have a great day. We'll talk to
you. Please remember, if you've missed any shows, just click on Show Archive and you'll find all of his shows. We look forward to seeing you here again next week for another episode of Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side.